server that we might have at home, could be a multi-disk system, or some storage appliance somewhere in a cloud owned by a private company, like Google or Facebook or some other company. Or it could also be within the company that we work for. And the issue is that since this is growing so fast, we're currently, we have this sort of a whole bunch of challenges that we have to face. One of these challenges is performance, and this is probably the most important one. We want to be able to access the files that we create quick. We don't want to wait for 10 minutes to be able to access the file, right? So, and this is something that as the number of files that we create increases and the rate at which we create them also increases, this is going to become a problem. And it's already some of, part of the problem because CPUs and memory are getting faster, and these are not getting faster at a pace that's able to catch up with those improvements. The other thing that we want is reliability. We want to be able to create a file now and access it 10 years or 15 years on the way, right? We don't want to lose our baby pictures or stuff that is important to us within some expanded window of time, right? The other thing is power consumption. Disks are always spinning, thus always consuming energy. And there have been improvements in CPU dynamic and dynamic voltage and frequency scaling to reduce their power consumption. Also, we see that our monitors turn off when we're not using them, and memory has similar improvements, but disks are always spinning. There is no way that a disk can service a request without spinning, right? So that's going to become an issue. It's already an issue in some places. The other thing is management. This might not be such an important issue for our laptop or desktop computers, but it's a big issue for storage administrators and data centers, or even typical systems administrator. They want tools that are easy to manage and allow you to create to service users in an effective way, without requiring much sacrifice or time from your part. And the final issue is security, right? We don't want anyone touching our files, right? We want to be able to be sure that our files are going to be there. No one is going to delete them, and no one is going to tamper them without us knowing it or allowing that to happen. So we identified that the good thing is that both industry and academia are willing to help and in these areas, right? They both want to improve storage. There are many storage companies out there, and there are many folks in academia who are working on solving this type of problems. And some of the areas that we have identified in our particular research that we can improve on is that storage systems, or more specifically file systems, typically use static data placements. That is, you create a file, it gets written somewhere in the disk, and it will remain there as long as that file exists. But we notice that this might not be good for performance because, let's say, we want files that get accessed a lot, placed on portions of the disk that are faster, or in a memory, or in a type of memory that's faster to access than the disk that we know is slow. So that's something that we can improve. The other thing that we can improve is that there are this whole range of storage devices, solid state storage devices to be more specific, that are coming out. And these storage devices are able to improve both power and performance. And that's something that's attracting a lot of attention from industry and academia currently, and we have some proposals in those directions. And other thing that is going to be important, like I said, every day we create a lot more data, and disks are not getting denser sufficiently fast enough, right? The pace that they were getting denser has become a little bit slower towards this last 5 years, so we need to get into fancier stuff like on-disk compression and stuff like deduplication, where we simply keep one copy of a particular block, right? However, there are some challenges to this, right? The first thing is that improving storage takes time. You have to have knowledge of how the storage system works and able to come up with a viable and feasible solution, right? And not only that, but after you've come up with a design, you have to implement it and make that work. And that is very hard. It's in our case, in our lab, the typical development time is up around 18 months per improvement that we make. So it's not very simple. And the worst thing is that even after we do this and we go through all those rounds of work, adoption is slow. People are not going to go in and just say, okay, I'm going to install this because this guy showed in a paper that this is really good. They're not going to be that trustworthy. And sometimes not even us that develop those things are trustworthy, right? So we have to have some mechanism that allows people to be sure that something works, and not only that it works, but it's easy to deploy, right? You can plug it in just like you plug in a video camera or a mouse, and it will work, and not only that, but if you plug it out, it will your system will still work after you unplug it, right? So then my thesis statement is that we improve the state of the art in block layer storage by designing and implementing self-management block layer extensions that utilize existing and emerging storage technologies in novel ways, just like the ones that I'm going to talk to you about in a few minutes. Then we identify what's common around this extensions and create an infrastructure to simplify their development. And finally, we also develop a theory that allows administrators and regular people to easily deploy storage extensions in systems that are already running. Okay, so what do we mean by self-managing stackable storage extensions? Well, the first thing that they have to be is autonomic. You have to be able to get that extension has to be able to work by itself and do up the optimizations without the user have to be inputting data to them, right? They have to be just standalone applications, in a sense. They have to be easy to develop. Like I said, in our case, it takes around 18 months. We want to shorten that time window to a reasonable amount of time, and not only that, but so that people that are not that don't have all the specific knowledge of the system of how the kernel works and how the storage stack works can develop extensions. And the final step is that we want to make them easy to deploy so that they can be you can take an extension, put it in. If you don't like what it's doing, you can take it out and do that sort of thing. So this leads me to three projects that we have worked on. The first one is Bort that improves performance. The second one is Access that lowers power consumption. And the last one is EDT, which improves performance, lowers power, and cost. I'll go into more details of each of these right now.
What's the meaning of those abbreviations?
Okay, so Bort is for block reorganization. Access is external caching on, I forgot the other. on energy efficient storage, and EDT is for dynamic stem-based tiering. Stem-based dynamic tiering.
What are the numbers, sir?
So those are the references.
Okay, so
Bort. So in Bort, we saw that we analyzed the workloads and found some interesting insights. The first one is that we have non-uniform access frequency, meaning that we have a small amount of data that gets accessed a lot, right? The other thing is that we have temporal locality. If you access some portion of the data, you're going to be you have a huge probability of that the next access is going to be near that one. And the last observation that we have is partial determinism, meaning that a sequence of access is very likely to repeat itself in the future, right? It may vary some part of it, but we have some a significant amount of determinism on that sequence of access itself. Let's say an the IOs and application issues when it's starting, right? It's bound to be the same every time you start the application, unless you upgrade the version of the application or something like that. But as long as the application stays the same, it's always going to issue the same sequence of IOs, right? So what's the current state of the file systems with regard to this? First, file systems optimize for sequential access of the entire files, meaning that you write a file, and it's typically going to be written sequentially on disk, so that when you access that file sequentially, you get the most throughput out of the disk. However, this is not always the way that applications access files. That's one thing to know. And the other thing to know is that there's little workload awareness. Like I said, an application always starts in the same way. But the file system doesn't know anything of that. If the file system were aware of this, it would be able to prefetch blocks that the application is going to be needing next instead of waiting for that IO to come. And as a result of this suboptimal performance, the result is essentially that we have suboptimal IO performance. So let me give you a more concrete example of what's going on. Assume that we have the following request sequence on this, let's call it this, and it's going to be go something like this. So A gets access first, then we go and have to make a seek to go to access 3, then another seek to access 6, and finally to access 1. So we see by all depicted in the dashed gray line that there are a lot of seeks for that particular sequence. And one thing that we can ask ourselves is, well, isn't our IO schedulers designed for all this? And the answer is yes. IO schedulers are designed to improve. Are designed in mind so that you don't have to seek that much. However, if those are read requests, you typically the next one depends on the previous one, then you will typically not have them all in the queue at the same time, right? So those seeks are an obligation that you have to do. So what can we do to help? Well, one thing that we thought of is, given that we know that sequence is very likely to occur, we can just put it in a separate place on the disk, and now all accesses are very small in terms of seeks, right? And this is exactly what we do with Borg. Borg takes and reorganizes data on a separate partition on the disk, and that reorganization is based on previous access patterns, and the idea is that if we concentrate most of the requests within that small portion of the disk, that the seeks are going to be really small, so we're going to be able to minimize the time we waste on those seeks, and also the other good thing about Borg is that we also try to minimize seeks to other parts of the disk by using a part of that partition as a write buffer, where we position writes that are to different portions of the disk, but we put them there, and then at some later point in time, we write them to the location where they were originally supposed to go. We have implemented Borg so that it's independent of the file system that is above it. And our studies indicate that it operates with very small background overheads. This is what the architecture of Borg looks like. Like I said, we're below the file system. It has three components within the kernel that are an IO profiler that tracks all IOs issued, an IO indirector which tells the system where the IO must go, either to its original location or to the optimized partition, and something that reorganizes the space. That layout is going to be given by the analyzer given an, sorry, it's going to be given by the analyzer when it looks at and the I/O patterns and extracts sequences of common I/O. Of common I/Os. Yes.
Is there anything that's coming down from the application as from the
No, it's completely independent of the application. Yes. Yeah. I can go into a little bit more detail on that. So essentially, what we do is that when we're in the kernel, we see which application is issuing that I/O, right? So we associate particular portions of the disk with applications by the process ID and by the name of the executable, and so we create sequences of blocks that get accessed per application. Right, so that's part of how we distinguish that. Okay, so
I have a
yes.
question.
Sure.
So I'm trying to imagine how this would look in a clustered file system, where you have, let's say, your blocks that you were looking at in the example are going to different disks in the system. Will Borg do this optimization per disk? Because it's possible that agency belongs onto different disks when you have a clustered system.
Yes, so when you have multi-disk systems, the idea that we have is have a separate board partition per disk so that we maximize throughput. And that way we spread out the sequence that gets accessed not only for in one disk, but take the use the throughput of all those disks in parallel. Right? So each disk will have its own partition, and the sequence will be spread out in array fashion or in a strict fashion along the disks.
Right. But another impediment I can see there is now the virtualization layer is split between the application issues in the I/O and the several disks in between, right? So because now you're dependent on which disk address you're actually accessing, and that might be hidden by the virtualization layers in between.
Usually, like I said, we have we operate at the block layer, so we simply transform an I/O that was to a disk and an offset to a probably different disk and offset.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I don't see what the issue is.
Your I/O could be to a particular the DA that we see, the logical disk address that we see, might actually translate into some other disk on the system that is then rated, right? So the block that is exported as part of the LUN or a volume actually reside on a RAID partition or reside on rated set of disk. So it'll be an interesting exercise to work out.
Yeah, I see your point. So you can have the virtualization one layer above the physical devices. That's what you mean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Virtualization above where Borg is sitting. So maybe Borg always would want to. I think it works best when it is closest to, or when it is below all the virtualization.
Yes, we believe so.
Okay.
So
the Borg partition is used to store reordered blocks.
Yes.
Will those boxes always stay in the Borg partition, or will they be moved?
No, so that's the job of, so we have this analyzer that runs periodically and comes up with a different layout plan. So that layout plan completely reorganizes that optimized partition.
But wouldn't that partition become full quickly?
Yeah, when it becomes full, I mean, you simply have still what's most popular in it. Right, so that simply means that it means that you're not able to hold the complete working set on that partition.
Just that hash.
Exactly.
So that means for those blocks that are in the Borg partition, there'll be at least two copies on the disk.
Yeah, there will be. There are two copies: the optimized and the original.
And how do you maintain the consistency?
Well, that's one of the issues that's hard. That when it's hard to implement. I mean, it's easy to visualize, but it's hard to implement. Usually, the optimized place, the place in the optimized partition is the latest. That's the semantics that we stick to. But yeah, guaranteeing that it's difficult in terms of implementation.
Can you also clarify the implementation you do for writes?
Yeah, so for writes, we simply have, like I said, we have the OPT partition, and in that OPT partition, we have a fraction of it that acts as a write buffer, meaning that all the writes are going to be not issued to the original place, but to that to that space if they don't have a mapping in the OPT partition originally.
What's the purpose of using that bus?
What's the purpose of that? Keeping seeks within that OPT partition, so that we don't have when a write comes, it would be the only normally it would be the only seek that we would have to do outside the OPT partition. But if we're able to buffer it, we're able to get away without doing that seek, which can potentially hurt performance.
Is the objective of putting sequential proxies together, or putting proxies that you think will be accessed together?
Putting blocks that we think they will be accessed together. Okay. So I have talked about all this related to Borg, but does it actually work? And here is a plot. We did many more experiments, but this is just one to showcase the performance. And we tried two workloads, a developer workload and an SPN workload. And black bars indicate that the SPN workload is you have an optimization of around 35% independent of the size of the Borg partition. Whereas for the developer workload, we see that it has a much larger working set, which stabilizes after 4 GB. Right? After 4 GB, you don't get much more improvement by expanding the size of the Borg partition. So Borg is sensitive to the size of the OPT partition, just like Min suggested, and the performance improvement will also vary depending on the workload.
How did you do the experiment? How did you do the profiling, and how did you test the improvement?
Yeah, so essentially we collected a trace, and then we replayed that trace in some cases. In other cases, like this next one, I'm on the next slide, the application startup profiles. Here we ran the applications. We ran a mix of them without any particular order. And then we reconfigured the Borg OPT partition, and then we ran them again in some random order, and these are the times that we got to load those applications to the start.
First run the profile.
Yeah, we first run the profile, let it train for some time, and then we reconfigure the partition and run a similar workload again. No, the mix is some random order.
Okay.
And actually, it was interesting because we saw that, for instance, in the OpenOffice suite of applications, even if we train for one of them, since they all have to load the same libraries, the optimization works for all of the applications. Right? So we train, let's say, for the OpenOffice writer, but then we open the OpenOffice presentation application. And we still saw the same improvement that we saw with the application that we trained for. So sometimes it's just the order in which similar applications work that we are able to benefit from.
Sorry.
Yes.
Let me understand this clearly. So you're trying to measure the startup time. Does that mean that you are actually measuring the effect to the read time for your board later?
Yes. So one thing that we do is that we clear the page cache before the start of the experiment.
Right.
So that the page cache, there's nothing there. So we're forcing the application to go to disk.
But this is only for read, right?
This has
nothing to do with the write.
Yeah, this has nothing to do with the write. For application startups. For the workloads that I showed before, they do have reads and writes.
I have another question for that one. So what's the difference? What's the major difference between the developer trace and the...
So developer was compile, code, Emacs, VI, that sort of applications, right? That was the workload, mostly. Compiling kernel, compiling different applications. and SVN was the workload that we saw on the SVN server.
What's the major difference?
So the major difference is that the SVN is writes followed by reads of the same content, whereas the compile is mostly it's reads of big portions of data, followed by writes of small portions to random locations, and yeah, it's basically it's more random, the developer workload, than the SVN. That's why we saw that the working set was smaller.
But the related question is the profile. I mean, for application, the profile is maybe can expect to be relatively stable. But for a trace, no matter it's development trace or SVN trace, depending on what kind of work that the users are doing, what kind of what's the similarity that you see from the profiles? Because comparing Linux kernel versus comparing Apache, trace may be quite different.
It may be quite different, but if you're a developer, you usually don't compile one thing once and then never touch it again. If you're working on something, then we expect that to eventually get to your Borg OPT partition, right? In one of the reconfiguration rounds, it will get to your OPT partition. And what simply doesn't get used, will not get a chance to go to that partition, right? So we expect that cache to be stabilized through time.
So I guess just that question actually leads to, if you were talking about a trace, you better have some kind of statistical sort of summary about that, because if you say, but I guess on the board part, I understand there are
I don't have them here in this presentation, but we did some significant amount of statistic analysis on those traces by looking at stuff like self-similarities within hours of the trace and heat maps of IO activity and that sort of information. That's in the proposal document and also within the paper that I referenced. Yeah, but we have some analysis of that. Also, the amount of let's say we did analysis like what's the percentage of data that gets accessed, what's the frequency of the let's say top 20% corresponds, the top 20% corresponds to what amount of IOs and all that sort of things. Yes.
Okay. Sorry to delay you further, but another really question is, so you track the application by process ID, right?
Process and name of the executable.
And then
both things.
Now imagine if this is on the distributed system server.
So in that case, you don't have much information from that unless you have some hints from a layer above, right? Because you lose that content. Yeah, that's one of the downfalls that we have. That typically the way the Borg was implemented, well, we usually optimize if all the processes are run on that machine. But what we can do, another thing that we can do is just run those IO profilers on the actual machines. That way we can extract a plan, a global plan, and because in the machines is where we have the process information.
Yeah, I guess this is relevant to the bigger question.
Okay. So the next project I'm gonna go through is Access. So the idea behind Access is that, like I said, disks are always spinning, so they consume a lot of energy. And one thing is that the OS is constantly doing writes to disk. It's doing either journaling or flushing dirty pages from the page cache. But actually, but those operations can get buffered, and actually, the operations that force to turn on the disk are read operations, right? So imagine that if we have this plot here of power usage through time. Currently, systems work like this way. They this consume a constant amount of energy, and then we have a read request that comes, and then a long time goes by until we see another read request, right? And through all that time, power consumption stays constant, right? And even after that request comes, right? So what we propose is have a system that consume some amount of power when the request comes, and if we don't see I/O for, sorry, read request for some time, we can simply turn off the disk, consume less amount of power, and then when the read request comes back, when we see another read request, we turn off the disk again and service that read. So the idea is to use a low power device to cache most of the read and write IOs, so that we don't have to recur to the disk such that we can keep the disk spun down for a maximum amount of time, right? So here we if we look at the design of the system, it's very similar to Borg. We have the same similar indirector that tells it to either send it to the disk or send it to the low power device. We have some trigger, something a trigger that involves a reconfiguration, that is when we have a read miss and we have to bring something to the cache, or simply turn on the disk. And then we have also this page access tracker, which keeps track of which pages are most frequently accessed, such that we can update our cache as access come by. Right? Okay, so here's a performance test of the system. For this test, we actually ran this is not trace-based, this is a benchmark called BLTK that executes applications, and it actually takes over the system and types something on the keyboard, saves the application and that type of things. It also compiles and does a whole bunch of things with as if a real user were doing them, right? So the first thing that we see is that if we take an idle system and just by plugging in the flash device or a different types of low power device, we actually consume additional amount of energy. And this is because the system has to be, the kernel typically wakes up the CPU, and that causes to query the state of the USB or flash controller, and that makes it consume a little bit more energy. Right.
Okay, can you clarify? So what kind of system you're talking about here? Single disk or what?
So this is this which we tested on laptops. Right? So the configuration that says USB is just a USB flash drive, and CF is a compact flash connected to the compact flash port or SD cards. Right? Okay, so
What's base and what
base is disk, only disk, right? Yeah, of a vanilla system. Laptop mode is a mode that Linux has in which it simply maintains a larger buffer so as not to write to the disk that frequently, and also that it increases the size of the pages from 4K to I think 1 megabyte or something like that.
Is the power consumption from the single disk or from the whole system?
The power consumption is the whole system.
The whole laptop?
The whole laptop, yes.
How do you measure that?
Using ACPI. In ACPI, we query the laptop, the battery, the amount of battery. Yeah, essentially, we unplug it from the power source and query the amount of battery, and that way we calculate the power that it consumes.
Why is the laptop mode consumes more energy than the base?
Essentially the reason that it does is that even because it's not well implemented. Essentially, it tries to buffer a larger portion and maintains it in the RAM and turn off the disk. But then it has the cost of spinning up the disk is very high. So it doesn't have a good balance of how big that cache needs to be and how frequently you need to turn on and off the disk. So that's why it's higher on the base case.
Okay.
Right. So, but what we did see is that there are some improvements with different configurations, but typically the improvement rate in the order of 2 to 14% when we use this system. And we have to clarify that this is overall system power, right? The whole including CPU, monitor and everything in the system. If we were to consider only this power, it would be the improvement would be much higher. But it's hard to be able to extract what the power consumption of each particular device is on laptops. Okay.
I think I missed. Did you say what the LM was?
LM is laptop mode. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
What's the trade-off on performance?
Yeah. So I don't have it in this presentation, but we did see some significant performance loss in order of about 15 to 30% in some cases. But we attribute that to having to random writes. Right? We didn't do any optimization for random writes to Flash,
mm-hmm.
and we know that Flash suffers from random writes. So yeah, so that's something that we left that as a to do,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay.
So this spin-up latency doesn't contribute to your performance degradation?
Yeah, that this spin-up latency contributes, but actually the random write is much worse than the this spin-up latency.
Okay.
In most cases that we saw. Okay. So the next project that I'm going to talk to you, and it's a third extension that I implemented, is EDT. And here we looked at three things that are making storage bad. Not performs suboptimally. The first thing is that, like I said before, there's non-uniform access pattern. There are few data that you access a lot, and that typically in data centers and enterprise, storage is provisioned is homogeneous, meaning that you have a whole bunch of disks with the same characteristics, and they're provisioned for peak I/O load. And like I said before, usually storage power consumption is independent of the load. So if we look at the example, we might have a system that has a bunch of SAS disks configured as RAIDs, and independently of how the workload looks through time, those disks are always going to be on, right? And not only that, but you need a whole bunch of disks in order to be able to satisfy your peak load or your peak demand. The idea that we have is, okay, so instead of having just SAS disks, we're going to have a mix of SSD, SAS, and SATA. And what we're going to do is that when the load is low, we're only going to have certain disks to satisfy those workloads. And when I put gray dashed lines means that that particular array is off. So, like I said, when the work is low, it's you have most arrays off. As it increases through time, we may have to turn them all of them on. Then if it decreases to a medium level, we might just require SSDs and SATA, and so on, right? The idea is here that we leverage the characteristics of each type of device, right? We know that SSDs are good for random I/O. We know that SAS are best for the sequential IOs, meaning that if you access something sequentially, you're going to get the most throughput out of SAS disks, and the SATA are good for data that you don't access that frequently, right? So archiving and that sort of stuff. And the idea that we have is essentially we consolidate when the load is low, we load balance when we have a high load. And we do this by migrating data among peers, right? As we see those workload variations. So how does this perform? Oh, sorry. This is the architecture of the system. Actually, in this case, we have a two system configuration because since we're substituting a bunch of SaaS devices for a smaller mix of devices, we have to come up with some way of determining what's the adequate configuration that we need to use. Right? So we have this configuration advisor that comes up with that configuration, and then someone installs that, and then we have the complete EDP system, which is similar to the other systems that we have looked at before, in the sense that we looked at IOs, we migrate them, we migrate data, and come up with placements, layout, and that sort of thing. So how does this perform? So in this slide, I have a 24-hour experiment. This top left plot shows the IO through time. The gray part is sequential IOs. The sequential part and the black part is random IOs. Here we see the power consumption. SAS is an old SAS system. EDT is our system, and IDT is if what happened if you were to place data only based on IOPS, right, without taking into account sequentiality. And we see that EDT outperforms all the systems in terms of power consumption. And not only that, but when we look at the cumulative response time through time, we see that the EDT curve is the one that guarantees the faster response time. Right, because it's the highest, so it guarantees the fastest response. So we saw with not only this one but various benchmarks that we ran, we saw an average response time reduction of around 40% of power savings up to 60%, and of capital cost savings up to 46%. Capital cost is the cost of acquiring those devices, right? Like I said, if we were to provision an all-SAS system, because we have to provision for the peak, we require many of those devices. But if we were to allow a mix of those devices with different characteristics and leverage those characteristics, we're able to reduce those costs substantially.
Does data have to be shuffled in background?
Yes. Data has to be, we're essentially continuously reshuffling the data. It's something like every 30 minutes. We do a complete reshuffling, but if we detect that some of the devices are throttled, meaning that it's getting more IOs than it can satisfy, at that point we load balance, right?
Would that be reshuffling cost performance?
There is some performance overhead because of shuffling the data or migration. But what we do is that we run those migrations at a paced rate, right? So that also they're running on the background and they're trying not to be hostile to the foreground IOs. So that we did some experiments with that and determined that I think 25% of the throughput of the disk is the optimal rate at which we run them so that we don't interfere with foreground IOs.
How about the additional power consumption because of the additional capacity?
So there's not significant additional power consumption because of that, because like I said, disks are always spinning, and the highest cost is just spinning the disk. That accounts for the highest percentage of the cost. So there is only a small delta when you service a request and when you're not doing anything in typical disk systems. Okay, so what are the takeaway lessons after we implemented all of this? The first thing is that the storage stack is a challenging programming environment, in particular the kernel. It takes a lot more time to develop in the kernel than in regular user land. The data consistency when moving it, it's a very big issue. That's something that is not easy to accomplish, and that requires a lot of work because there are many border cases which we have to take care of. Also, that we have to handle non-aligned I/O. Sometimes we may have, let's say, in the case of Borg, an I/O that is part in the OPT partition and part in the regular placement. So we have to split that I/O into two, and that sort of cases. right? And not only that, but sometimes the IO is coming on phase aligned, and that complicates things a lot. And also, we don't want our systems to break after reboots, right? So we need those mappings of data to devices to be persistent. And that turned out to be a really difficult issue that we had to face. And we've also found out that most of the code was just in handling border cases, and handling error recovery and that sort of thing. And that not only is the most lines of code, but it's the hardest to code and debug. And also from the administration point of view, we saw that determining how a block extension influences a volume is not easy. And not only that, but what happens when we mix those extensions together, that's even harder to do. I mean, it's non-trivial what happens if you mix Borg and Exos in the same system, for example. And finally, making good decisions sound decisions to deploy those extensions in a particular order is something that we found non-trivial. I'm going to give a little bit more details into this next. And this is essentially what the ABLE project goes into. The idea in ABLE is that we change the status quo, the current status quo, by improving developer experience, making extensions more easy to develop, simplify administration, by providing an automated reasoning engine that's based on a sound theory that allows administrators to be sure of what they're deploying. And concretely, ABLE provides an infrastructure for developers to write extensions. It provides a proven theory that when an administrator makes a decision, it's going to do what he thinks he's doing. It provides tools for administrators to do that, and we also provide some case studies around how people would use this system.
Okay, you have 5 minutes according to the 15-minute timeline, but I think you probably need not more than 10 minutes.
Okay, I'm going to go a little bit. Okay. Okay, so this is what the architecture of ABLE looks like. We essentially provide a range of functionality via libraries here, and a reasoning engine that will help the administrator deal with it. And here on the extensions that people will install on ABLE will be here on the extension stack, and they will interact with the primitives that we have on ABLE. Okay, so what are the benefits for developers using ABLE? So we took this set of 5 extensions, and we saw that when we implemented them on ABLE, we had these reductions that we have listed here, ranging from 12 to 76% on the case of our RAID 1 extension. But most importantly, extensions that code that has to deal with kernel, which is typically the most complex to write, is where we saw the highest benefits, right, ranging from 20 to 90% of the extension code reduced, code that the developer doesn't have to write. Right. Okay. So, and not only this, but the other good thing that we saw is that all this was accomplished with very little added overhead of less than 4.5% in the worst case. And for administrators, like I said, ABLE provides a sound theory. I'm going to skip this slide and just give you an example of how would an administrator use ABLE. So imagine that we have 2 extensions. The first one is IO Shepherding, which is a paper by some folks at Wisconsin. And the idea behind that extension is that it improves reliability by retrying fail IO. So if an application issues an IO and that IO fails, it verifies that. It checks that and reissues that IO, making sure that it succeeds. And then we have an Exos, which we already saw. So if we want to deploy those 2 extensions together, we have 2 choices. We either put in the source stack, right? We either put the I/O shepherding above access, or we put access above the I/O shepherding. So in terms of how the extensions interact with the system, we see that the I/O shepherding takes us input the disk and outputs the disk, and access inputs the disk and writes to both disk and flash. Right. So here's how these extensions look like. We have black arrows for regular IOs, dashed line for access IOs, access generated IOs, and gray line for IO shepherding generated IOs. So if we were to place IS above access, we see that the IO shepherding will generate some additional IOs, which access will redirect them either to the disk or to the flash device, right? But if we were to put access above the IO's shepherding, we would see that in this case, access will still generate the IOs to both disk and flash, but the flash IOs will not get the benefit of reliability that we saw in the other case.
I have one basic question.
Yes?
Each extension has to be stackable. Cannot be on the same level?
No, because you cannot say this IO will go to all extensions on the same time and they will modify them, right? How would you merge all those modifications?
No. Let's say you have some system which improves on read, you have some system which improves on write.
Mm-hmm.
Based on the type of IO, you send one request to the read improver, you send IO request.
Yeah, if they have, let's say, we call those domains, if they have completely completely separate domains of operations, they're practically at the same level. But if their domains of operations mix, then you have to have some order in which you execute them. Right? Okay. So the idea behind the extension stacking rules is that they allow to determine the influence of an extension on data volumes by analyzing, like I said, the domains of operations. And also, the idea behind that analysis is that that you will get some idea of which extension dominates, saying, okay, this one is, if you follow this particular ordering and have this and this output domains, this extension will be prevalent on your system, meaning that its IOs have the higher priority that the goals of those extensions will be accomplished in a higher priority than the other extensions. Just like what we saw when we placed IO shepherding above access, we saw that reliability will get most benefit, whereas as we did the converts and we saw that only IOs to the disk got the additional reliability benefit. Okay, so just to summarize what ABLE has, what ABLE provides, it has an infrastructure to help developers develop extensions, and we saw significant reductions in lines of code, and we also provided a sound stacking theory for administrator to reason about extensions as building blocks.
How does it mean use ABLE? Does it mean as a job to challenge?
No. The idea is that ABLE, the administrator will say, okay, I want to accomplish some goal, let's say performance, right? And I have this set of extensions. And ABLE will try out all the combinations and say, okay, this particular stacking order is the one that you should use to accomplish performance. That's essentially how the admin will use ABLE. Okay, so when talking about ABLE, I left out a very important part of the requirements for extension is persistent data structures. And it turns out that we did the survey among different extensions, developed some by us and some by other people, and we saw that all of them require some sort of data structure to be persistent. Right? And like I said before, achieving this is not easy. There are many border cases that one has to take care of, serializing data structures, deserializing them, and so on. So just to put an example, if we were to operate with a tree, and if we want to make that tree persistent, we see that the first thing that we have to do is keep track of all the allocations that tree makes. That's very complicated. And not only that, we have to keep track of all the changes that it makes. So imagine that we have this tree and we insert node 17. Since it's a balanced tree, we actually have to modify a lot more nodes than the node that we inserted it, right? So the red nodes indicate the ones that were modified. So we end up modifying half the trees just by inserting one value. And keeping track of those changes is not very easy if we want to do it often. If we want to do incremental writes to what was only modified. And not only that, but we have to serialize this tree somehow. And that it's feasible, but more that complicated data structures, it might be more difficult to do.
Okay, you'll have to wrap up.
Okay, so let me go very quickly on this. So the idea behind this project is developers provide the top level of what they want to make persistent, and the system will automatically make persistent. And the idea is that we essentially, I'm on slide 41 right now. The idea is essentially that we have some root structure, and our system SoftVM will follow all those pointers in those root structure to the and copy from the volatile to the persistent region, change the pointers, continue free the previous location, and continue that process until essentially you run out of things pointing from the persistent to the volatile, and then finally you fix the references from volatile to persistent. On slide 42, we see that using ABLE, we have substantially decreased on the amount of lines of code required to make independent data structures persistent. And finally, we see that ABLE performs, SoftVM performs quite well in terms of, this is a memcached workload. And here we measure operations per second, memcached DB, with different data structures. Here we have a Berkeley DB with a B-tree, Berkeley DB with a hash table, and SoftVM, and we see that SoftVM significantly outperforms Berkeley DB in all cases by as much as 10x, and from 2x to 10x. I'm going to skip this, and I'm going to go all the way to slide 45 with future directions. And up to now, I have showed you three storage extensions that showcase performance, power, and cost savings. I have showed you an infrastructure to simplify the development process of storage extensions and a mechanism to easily develop and manage persistent data structures. And finally, a theory to reason about how one would stack these storage extensions. What remains to be done is that understand how do I pick a particular extension that accomplishes the same goal, right? So if I have, let's say, a caching and a tiering extension, and that both have very similar goals, which one is the best? How do I pick them, right? So I'm going to study that process of how to make that decision. In the next part of my work, here are some references that I quoted to the presentation. I would like to finally acknowledge my committee members and my collaborators and co-authors throughout this work. Here are some of my publications, and with this I finish, and I will take questions from all of you now. Right? It's yes. From everyone.
Can you identify the publications, your publications that are specific to your proposal?
Yeah. So specific to the proposal, the first publication, this second publication, this one, and this one. Only the second one is the one that's not completely specific to the proposal. Yes.
A question. You mentioned three projects. Are you the only one to implement all of these?
No. That's here is a list of the papers that were published with that word, and most of them were done with people in the lab, and one of them, the EDC project, it was in collaboration with folks at IBM.
So in that sense, in your presentation, you should clearly identify your contribution on each project instead of introduce the three projects as a whole.
Okay.
And later students may have the trouble to present their proposal or design.
I
think it may have overlap.
Are the materials that you presented all made by you?
All what?
All the materials. Are you the leading developer of all the materials?
Not on all the materials. So the way it works is that for Access and Board, all the code that was written was mostly done by Louis and I, and in case of Board, Meta. And for Access, for instance, all the experiments were done on my laptop, so I did most of them. I mean, it's very hard to identify particular pieces of work that each one of us contributed in those projects because we were so tightly coupled. However, in the first publication, the EDP work, the design was made by all of us. However, all the implementation and experiments were done by me. So
Is it possible then, since you are the first one, the later PhD students may have a difficulty to have their write-up because the major part already presented on your proposal or thesis?
Well, I think even I will have a difficulty identifying exactly what my contributions are because, like I said, the development process was we were so tightly coupled that I don't know exactly to pinpoint my specific contributions on that project.
So I was, again, maybe I'm wrong, I still suggest that when you write your thesis, because you need to read the noon for the later PhD
That's
otherwise, we'll be difficult for them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Several chapters are...
Yeah, so one thing to mention is that although we all looked at the same extensions and the same project, all three of us looked at them from a different perspective, right? Louis looks at them from a caching perspective. I looked at them from a simply and storage extension perspective. Meta looked at them as from a different perspective, just in terms of improving performance. So in that sense, we're all disjoint. Even though we're all on the same project, we view the project as a completely different thing altogether.
Okay, so that's a good point. When you write your thesis, follow this direction,
so
the other way to look at this is out of the four papers, they're relevant to the proposal, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have the first author, two of them, so you can claim at least 50% of the contribution, right?
There are two papers that are not listed in,
mm-hmm.
which are in progress.
Yeah, exactly.
Which are basically done, but not listed here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The label one and the soft PM.
And the soft PM one. Those are under submission.
And that, Jorge, is the first up.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what's next? What are you proposing?
So like I said, what's meant to be done right now is what happens when extensions have the same goals, right? The theory that I have built deals with cases when you have different extensions with different goals. But when they have the same goal, it's not clear how to choose, which extension would perform better. And the use case that I'm going to study is what happens when you have an extension that does caching, meaning that it caches popular data on faster devices, or an extension that does queuing, that essentially looks at the data over a period of time and makes a, let's say, more informed decision, right? Both extensions have the same goal of improving performance, but they do it in completely different ways. So I'm going to study what happens. I mean, I'm going to study how do you choose among those two in different scenarios, right? And that's the use case that I'm going to build in the remaining part of my work.
Do you have a timeline?
Well, the timeline is to have a submission, is to have this ready by this December in order to have a submission and a presentation by June next year in terms of wrapping up all those work by June of next year.
So you're doing a plan to a design center?
Yeah, that would be the perfect scenario for me. And also a conference presentation.
Mm-hmm. So in this case, if you have outside committee members, please make sure to get permission from the UCF to allow them remotely participate in the event.
Okay.
It takes time. So.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Any other questions from committee members or the audience?
Raju, can I have, or George, can I have some questions?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. My first question goes back to what I believe Ming was talking about also, is the contribution. I know that the presentation is very, very good. I like the presentation. Just to get the positive note, I like your effort in building a presentation in Latin. I liked it very much, really. And your overall very, very clear and etc. Really, but I'm not exactly sure that which part exactly you have contributed. And this is more a because this is not a conference presentation. This is more a PhD dissertation presentation or PhD proposal presentation. So somehow you need to identify your sole contribution very clearly. That's otherwise it will be trouble because, say for example, I have been in Meda's committee and I know Meda talked quite a bit on the board in her presentation, in her thesis presentation, and you're also talking about the board. So if both of you try to claim the board as your thesis, that will be problematic because the part of the rule of the PhD thesis that is that. It has to be a sole contribution, really. That's one of the rules. Yeah, I very much understand that you have to collaborate, but somehow you need to distinguish your work from others, basically, very clearly. That's not clear. That didn't came up. It came up that way the presentation is done. It came up like everything has been done by the group, and it's a very good presentation from that perspective. That's one point. Okay. And the second point, you can address it later on. So let me point the second question also, and you can address it together. The second question or the second concern is in the very micro level concern is the soft PM. When I go through the soft PM description, I read your thesis, I try to understand from your presentation. It seems to me like it's the old days object storage system, like the way you're describing it, a two-level pointer, that's exactly the way any object storage or persistent storage used to work. Like you have a root node, you say the root node is persistable, then everything that is reachable from the root node gets persisted automatically into the disk. And any node that is not defined as persistent, those are kept in the memory. So that's the way the object storage is managed in most of the scenarios. So from that perspective, I don't see any difference from that. You need to distinguish that a little bit.
Yeah. Early. Okay. Can I address that now? Or
yeah.
Okay.
Please.
Regarding soft PM, so like you said, object store provided a similar interface. However, the problem with object stores is that the programming interface was completely different. The infrastructure that I'm proposing with SoftPM doesn't require significant modifications in terms of the program. It only, if we look at, let me see which slide it is. If we look at slide 42, we see that it's a very minimal. The amount of modifications that we have. In our case, it's just to identify which structure is the root, and that's it. Whereas the object structure, you completely have to change. I mean, yeah, for using soft PMs, developers will still use their regular malloc, do assignments the same way, don't have to track any of that. The system will do it automatically. Whereas if we were to use object store, we would have to do everything in a different way. We have to be conscious of all the mallocs, of some assignments and that sort of thing. So it's much more those previous work were much more required a significant higher effort from the developer than soft PM DOS, right?
I George, I will contradict on that because I have personally done quite a bit of coding, actual coding on the Poet object store and merchant, the three major object database. I have done programming in all of these three early. And the conversion time, I have converted very large systems, very large data center systems into the these object storage systems, and the conversion is very minimal. Like within half an hour, I used to convert like a 50,000 lines of code. So if you that argument will not be convincing to me.
Yeah. So one thing is that so those systems that you mentioned, I think they're implemented in Java and C++, right?
They have Java interface, they have C++ interface, C interface, and because they have the C++ and C interface, they have the PHP, all the different language bindings.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would have to check on that, but as far as we know, all the systems that we looked at, none of them provide this ease of programming for a C-type language, where you don't have any object metadata associated with a type, and you have to derive that either at compile time or at execution time, right? So
because the difference between the C and the C++ is that in the C++ you do not have the function pointer as the first argument, or explicit function pointer as the first argument, or the structure pointer as the first argument, and you can emulate C++ with the C by pointing that to the function easily. That emulation has been done before the C++ came up, or even after the C++ came up, people have done that emulation to write object-oriented code in C. So that emulation is not that difficult.
I mean, I'm very familiar with that sort of emulations. My point is that, I would have to double check on that. But as far as we know, all the systems that we looked at, none of them provide the simplicity that we're trying to provide with soft PM. In all cases, you require a lot more changes than with soft PM, and it was like I said, most of the type systems, you have that data the type metadata available at runtime, so you can do a lot more, you can infer more things at runtime, and also with soft PM, we're not, one thing that I sort of failed to mention is that we not only provide this interface for persistent data structures, but we also optimize the way that they're written to disk. We keep track of changes. We optimize the actual way that they're written to disk by providing a driver for different types of storage, and that's something that I don't believe that those systems provide. I guess that they usually write to a file or something in that fashion.
Okay. Anyway, I'm not completely. I don't agree with you completely.
Okay.
I'm very confident on those systems. As I said, that I've actually done coding on those systems quite a bit already. Just for the sake of argument, I'm sure that you have done something that is unique. What I'm trying to tell you is that uniqueness is not coming out of your presentation.
Okay.
So what else?
It has to be more clearly identified.
Go through those three systems: Percent, Object Store, and the Poet, the main three object database systems, and any other that is available nowadays, kind of things. And try, you need to make the comparison with them if you're talking about the line of code, if you're talking about the easiness, and etc., or if you're talking about the language interfaces. Your comparison, I do not see those comparisons in your presentations.
Okay.
So you need to highlight that very clearly. Otherwise, you'll have traveled a little bit.
Okay. Okay, yeah, that's a very good point.
Okay. And the other thing that I mentioned on the first question regarding the separation of the work, you don't need to address it immediately, mm-hmm. but I would say that sit down with the Rajiv very carefully and distinguish that just for the sake of otherwise you may have trouble from someone else.
Okay.
Because it needs to be distinguished very clearly. There should not be any overlap with the other thesis, etc. Because I have seen scenarios before where someone submitted thesis, then the university came back, or someone came back, not from the committee, but someone came back and said later on that, okay, no, this thesis has been, these pages are exactly the similar, this conclusion is exactly the similar from the other thesis from the same lab, really. And that should not happen, really. You should avoid that.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I will make sure of that.
Yeah. That's it.
Okay, thank you, Gautik.
Any other questions? No questions from the students?
Oh, Sajib asked one.
Oh, you did.
I know your private question.
No curiosity? I'm sure you have like tens of questions in your mind.
You don't ask me, you only have a chance. When you get the upper part of you ask you questions.
Okay,
there are five questions.
Okay, if there are no questions, then I think we'll enter the closed room session with Jorge and the committee members.
Nice doing this, man.
Thank you.
Has left, so it's just us and Jorge, the committee and Jorge. And so if you have any questions that you would like to ask him, perhaps any clarifications, I know you asked some of the contribution related questions earlier. If you want to expand on any of that, or if Jorge would like to explain better what his unique contributions are, we could do it now. And more importantly, I would like to ensure that, you know, all the committee members understand the direction of the thesis that Jorge is planning for, and suggest changes that you think would help to improve or clarify his thesis. So we are now open for any and all comments, clarifications. Jorge, if you would like to expand on anything, any of the earlier questions, now that you can do that too. Or if there are other questions from the committee members, we can go for those too.
So I think actually, for system research, it's typical that you have multiple people actually working on the same system. I think the point you have to make here is what specific aspects on the system. So it generally, given presentation, that's all right, because you're introducing the system, that this is the system, that is the overall architecture, this is the components, these are the things, why this works, why it performs like this. That is all fine. But when you really drill down to the contribution, you have to sort of say, here, I'm looking at the block layer optimization. I look at this. This is my own work. And that has to be very clear. And you can't just say, well, here's a paper, and you just copy-paste the paper onto your thesis. That's not work. Because if you do that, you won't be able to do that. I think that's a very good point.
Yeah.
You won't be able to do that. Right. So you have to be very, very careful
I have a different view on this in terms of reusing material from papers, joint papers, especially in thesis. I think if it's a joint contribution where people write a paper together,
right,
then they all share ownership on the material, right? So each person can actually reuse the material, right, from the paper, as long as they distinguish what the contributions, their unique contributions are,
But I'm open to suggestions for even, you know, if you think that that's not a good approach, or if you think that creates confusion, then and if you think that Jorge needs to make sure that all the sentences are unique from other disciplines.
No, what I meant here is, in the general discussion, because paper is a very succinct description of what you have done, right? Here is the methods, here are the different components of the system, here is the experiment, here are the results, and here are the papers, right? So, but if you actually have to get down to the thesis, and this is your opportunity to really sort of expand some of the things that you can, right? That's important. So you can say, well, here's the introduction. I mean, everybody is doing this part. I mean, you know, you can't really just say, let me paraphrase or whatever, just, you know, trying to repeat what I've said in the paper. That's not necessary. And you can put that, but, you know, it's important for you to add your part and eliminate what you have.
Right, so the point that I'm, maybe I can summarize and someone can improve on it is that while it's okay to share material at a high level with other theses, it is important to clarify in your thesis and certainly in your final PhD presentation, you know, your unique contribution with respect to that work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, in your case, it's easy because you built those systems and you're using those systems as examples, as opposed to saying that, okay, Borg is the best performing storage optimizer out there. You're not saying that. You're saying we built an optimizer, it seems to work well, but then there are a whole bunch of problems when you start building systems like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're trying to solve those problems that come out of building such systems. You're involved in building such optimizations, so you know firsthand what the problems are, right? And if you present it in that way, as opposed to focusing on the performance improvements or the power improvements, then it might be clear where you're going with your particular dissertation.
Right. And also to add to that, a thesis means you have a thesis, right? So that means you have a specific view of what you are trying to implement, trying to design, right? That, you know, even though you span your work, your efforts into multiple projects, but they should have a common theme. It's not a compilation simply just put a paper together. I co-author this paper, here is all my thesis. I co-author that paper, I work on part of that paper. Here's one of my thesis. You have to have a clear sort of storyline to some extent. This is your office. I think you did a very good presentation. I mean, in the beginning you laid out, you know, this is what I see as the system as, you know, drawbacks, so these are the things that need to be improved. Obviously you have a general view of what you want to implement the system, adding extensions and those sort of things. So this actually streams through the entire thesis, and doing that will clarify and distinguish your work from others. That's because you look at the system in this aspect, right? So if, you know, Luis or any other student actually come in, they come in from a different aspect. So your concentration, your focus is different. You're looking at things, you do experiment differently, or you design different components of the system. That'll make your work unique.
Right. And that was one of my suggestions when I saw a draft of Jorge's proposal, where I suggested that he move most of the material in those three different systems that he participated into an appendix, because all the details of implementation and the performance and evaluation and so on are not the core of your thesis. And you'll see in his dissertation that all of that material is separated out into appendices, which is more appropriate in my view. And so I guess my question is, do you feel that even the appendix material should be, you know, presented in a unique fashion, or if it's supplementary, it's okay to just put what information or data is available from the papers directly? So what is your, I mean, I would like to hear about the committee's take on that.
Okay, I feel that, first of all, I agree with both the Jason and Sergeant philosophy. I feel that if you are the first author, you can claim 99% of the contribution credit.
Wow.
So you can
It depends on
yeah.
the level of contribution.
Yeah. But the general view of the community. Think of I'm a person that in the community I don't know how at all. Okay, and that's
one of the things that you have to leave room for your
yes.
your fellow students. You can't say, this is my paper and it's done.
Not just the fact that someone is a first author on a paper implies always that they contributed.
I ask them. But the general perception community that the first author should be the one that has done most of the work. Okay. So if you're not the one that has done most of the work and you are the first author, then maybe you should be more careful. But the more important point is that if you're not the first author, I think it's dangerous for you to copy to use most of the materials from that paper. Okay. And really the comment is that you even have to distinguish your dissertation from my dissertation. I think that echoes a cautious point. Because that is prior art, that is already there, that is already collected by the Congress in the library. Okay. So you have to distinguish, you have to, if it's necessary, you have to spend a substantial discussion to distinguish with from that.
Right. Okay. I think, all of these concerns are easily addressed, and this is my suggestion, is to take the view that you are involved in building certain storage optimizations and just focus your discussion on the lessons that you learned and which aspect of the systems that you built enabled you to learn those lessons.
Okay.
Right? And if you look at this that way, then you are not claiming that, okay, this... And perhaps it's also... you know, advisable to say that in your acknowledgements or initial part of your thesis where you have the opportunity to acknowledge all kinds of people in the world who helped your thesis, you can state explicitly that, you know, the Borg work or the Ipsos work was done in collaboration with so-and-so people, and if you're not a primary contributor or not claiming certain aspects of the contribution, then you can use that space to elaborate on those aspects as well.
Be especially careful with the papers, the materials from the papers where you're not first on.
Okay.
A really suggestion, which maybe be some controversial to the other community members, is that I feel that your presentation, maybe as well as your proposals, should give more focus on the depth, not breadth. That's my feeling. Obviously, you have done a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt about that. Okay. But the fact that you're trying to cover everything in your presentation, you don't have time, right, to go deep into each one of them. But the people are interested in knowing the details. And for PhD, depth is very important.
Okay.
I don't know whether you already have secured a job offer or not, but when you go and give a job talk, you need to have that. Maybe, you know, what people do is focus on one of the projects and go really deep and use the other ones. You just briefly mention the other ones. And
I think I completely agree, and I would certainly make sure that Jorge does that for his defense,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And since this is a proposal and the opportunity to get feedback on all elements of the proposal, I suggested that he do a broad presentation of all the materials. And if there are any questions about depth, I think certainly we should engage those questions and address them now, and especially if there are suggestions as to which parts can help with more depth. I think, you know, we should talk about those now. But the intention with a 15-minute talk was to open up room for feedback which can help the final dissertation that Jorge still has, you know, 9 months to work on.
One of the things I just want to ask to erase that question after your talk, it's an important one. You're giving a proposal. You're not giving a paper presentation, right? So you have to, look at your proposal and give one page about future work.
Yeah, I was about to say that.
Right, so it's all right to some extent, but you need to sort of basically, why we have to have the proposals. Well, one thing is that you have actually spent substantial effort in terms of sort of getting into this area and be able to get, you know, preliminary results. On the other hand, you have to plan ahead what exactly you're going to do before your graduation, right? So if you say, I'm actually looking forward 8 months or something like that, 10 months.
right? So that's my preservation. And these are the research questions that I have. I know you know that in your mind.
Yes,
but
yes, it has to be laid out.
You need to lay out that. So but for this one, I don't see that's a critical issue, but, you know, in the future, in terms of, you know, giving proposal, I think it's very important for people to actually lay that down about these are the expectations I want to ask you, these are the directions I want to pursue. It's very clear. So that's one of the things that I think is missing.
And how come for you know, not just one thing. I'm sure you have many ideas in your mind, right? So don't get the official work that just the overhand. Lay out your ideas. Some of them you can even pursue after graduate, you become a researcher. Right? So lay out them. Even your final dissertation, I would suggest have at least 10-20 pages on the future direction. Your vision.
Okay.
Right? Your vision is very important for independent research, right? So don't take that as just an overhand. It can be very valuable.
To address the question that Raghu raised just earlier about the appendices, I don't think it's necessary, as a matter of fact. I think it's important for you to focus, because you've got to write your thesis. Thesis is very detailed about how you actually take on and solve a particular problem, right? So that's in your chapters. I mean, the appendices are not for attaching the papers with these people that have the papers previously. Well, people can just go and read the papers which you reference, obviously. I think it's important for you to concentrate what it is. You can say, well, this is the work, by the way, here's the result of the outcome of the system. And by the way, this is a paper in collaboration with someone that, you know, work out the system. This is not where you can actually sort of say that and be able to sort of put that data down and say this is the overall outcome of the project, which is fine. But I think it's important for you to sort of basically carve out distinguishing work that you have done with respect to each other project and actually put that under the same umbrella about what you see as a sort of system approach to sort of looking at the whatever that you have talked about in the beginning and try that through your thesis.
Yeah, those are all good points. I haven't written the pieces before, so I don't have the prior experience of
that's the reason we are having this meeting today is to allow you to absorb the best ideas from all of us to create a thesis that hopefully better than the thesis that we all wrote.
Guys, I have a couple of thoughts on the discussion that's going on. So Jorge, again, great presentation.
Thank you.
It flowed very well, and I got all the main points. So one of the thoughts that I had early on was related to storage extensions, and a feeling that I got was it would be really helpful if you set the scope of it a little in a little more structured fashion. So I kept asking myself the question of, is this for an enterprise storage system? Is it for a consumer device like a laptop? Is it for a personal computer? So those are the kind of questions. I'm not sure how much of that, maybe some of the techniques span all these different domains, but I kept asking myself that question. And I think, at least for the extensions part, if you're taught or maybe some thoughts around some classification of the extensions, some scope for these extensions, I thought could be really helpful in clarifying things. I'll state a couple of things and then I'll let you get to them in order. So based on the discussion that we've been having, Raju was suggesting about how the extensions could go into the appendix, and I have a different take on that. I mean, I think to come up with something like ABLE, it's equally important to spend time building one of these things. And perhaps EDP, since, as you mentioned, that was one of the things you focused on, you could use that as one of those things where you work down deep in the system trying to, and that gives a different perspective. And maybe you can use that as a building block, and perhaps Borg and, the caching project could supplement that experience that you had. And I think that forms an equally important component of being able to come up with something like ABLE and reason something about something like ABLE. And the other thought that I had was in terms of, you know, the time that you spent in the presentation and the effort that you, if ABLE comes out as the more important contribution, I'd like to see more work behind ABLE. For instance, something to do with the practicality of building a system like that. So a more general survey of how the different extensions, especially the current extensions in storage systems. I guess once again, I'm thinking from an enterprise storage viewpoint, and I'm thinking, would a company like IBM pick up ABLE and try the different storage extensions that they have, or the kind of things they offer in their products? And maybe I'm happy to bring that enterprise storage perspective, if I can, to the pieces and help you think along those directions. But I think that would be an important question that would be good to address, especially if you, in a, as you think about the scope of this work.
Okay, thanks, Bindu. Yeah, that's a definitely very, very important point. Yeah, and it's something that I have to lay out more carefully. I have to, but in general, just to answer your question, the idea behind ABLE is for enterprise because, like I said, I mean, one would, it's mostly for enterprise because it's typically where you have the more challenging storage problems. But ideas developed there span all types of storage, from laptop to enterprise data center sort of storage systems, because if extensions, like I said, were easy to deploy and you can put it in and take it out as you want, you could see them more ubiquitous, right? So you could probably download them and try them out and see if it worked for you or not, and that sort of thing. And that's the idea behind the theory of ABLE, that also since administrators are significantly more cautious than maybe someone trying out something in their laptop, that's why we provided the theory of ABLE, so that administrators can make a decision that makes sense for them, right? That it actually accomplishes what they want. So in that sense, probably the infrastructure part is for everybody, but the theory part is mostly for admins or people who are more conscious of what they want to deploy on their storage systems. That's how I would put it. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very good point. It's something that I have to work on more on the dissertation, on how to lay out that idea more in a more clear way.
And I think the benefit you have is you have a substantial amount of time to now work on your dissertation, and so that you structure it based on all the feedback that you had today.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with all the feedback that you've got. It's important to define scope well, where something like what you're proposing would be useful or not, and define your unique contributions and have a thesis, right, which is where you say that this is the direction that I considered, I worked on it, I built something, I evaluated it, and here are the conclusions. And that, the essence of that thesis flows through your dissertation in a nice way. So I do completely agree with all of that feedback. Any other suggestions?
One suggestion is that since you claim autonomics as part of the contribution of table, I would suggest you to elaborate on the background of autonomics and also related work.
Okay.
There's a lot of related work on autonomic management of services.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's missing in related work section. But also in your presentation, not everybody understands what that means and what autonomics means. So.
Okay.
We can do some background there.
And, you know, certainly follow up with Bindu on her offer to guide you through some of those
yes.
enterprise
the type of decisions and
of, mm-hmm. of things and how something like Able could be, you know, used in such environments. And also with Kaushik on the OddSeq database expertise that he has.
Yes, yes. Yeah, both of them are very useful, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Okay, any other questions for Jorge? And if not, you know, we'll enter another closed room with, but Jorge will leave us now and, you know, we can talk further more freely if you want on any concerns that you might have. So if you want to leave
okay.
the room, I'll come and find you.
Okay.
In the lab again.
Thank you.
And I'll bring your laptop to you.
Okay.
Okay, so I think this is the time to sort of lay out any major concerns that you might have, and I'll make sure that you know your concerns are addressed as much as I can by communicating with Jorge and working with him to address those concerns. So I already know some of the concerns with respect to you know, identifying unique contributions, scope, differentiation from some of the related work, some missing related work with respect to autonomic. So if there is anything that I'm missing in this list, please tell me.
Future work,
yes. So, yeah, future work is certainly important for the current proposal document. And
I think in terms of proposal document, that's fine. I mean, just that sets the note that the future when your students coming out of that.
Yes.
Yes. But in terms of satisfying a proposal requirement, you know, they ask for 5 pages abstract.
It's a proposal.
I don't think you should end on that and spend time on that. It should, you know, work on these pieces right away. It should not actually spend time on that. I don't have any other input. I think, you know, we probably have a pretty extensive discussion about the pros and cons and the stuff that the comments that I've already made.
Right. I mean, if there is, I mean, particularly I would like to hear about, you know, suggestions for improving any aspect of Jorge's work, ranging from writing to presentation to how he addresses questions or verbal communication that you, you know, may not be comfortable directly telling him. I can, since I get to meet him more often, I also have the opportunity to, you know, slide these things in gently. So if you want to, you know, make any suggestions along those lines, I'll be very happy to, you know, use them.
Roger?
Yes.
Yeah. I just want to overstress the object storage thing.
Okay. Yes. I think that message was heard loud and clear. And so. I mean,
I'm just too scared on that aspect. Hope not.
Right. Well, to give you a little bit of background, we did look at Versant carefully. We looked at what you know, the capabilities that Versant had. Unfortunately, I think Jorge did not have the opportunity today to address the specific differences. I think we, if I'm not mistaken, some of those differences are addressed in the proposal document, but perhaps not to sufficient detail as you might like, right? So we're going to look at some of these systems that you pointed out in particular in more detail and make sure that, you know, the contributions
InSoft PM are identified more precisely. Anything else? Any other feedback? And if not, the only other thing that remains is we need to decide whether Jorge's PhD proposal was acceptable in terms of the level of contribution, in terms of overall direction for the dissertation. And if yes, then if there is agreement, and then we all get to sign a document. And if not, Jorge gets to do this presentation once again.
I can comment that I've been in many FIU in your department's presentation, as you know, early, and this is probably one of the top presentations to me early. So I have no reservation on giving in the top grade, whatever you think needs to be done.
Okay. Thanks, Kaushik. So any other input on this question? Should I say we are in agreement?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that's great. And I think I'll let Jorge know, of course, that you know, things are on track, but he needs to address certain concerns very carefully. And he will be getting in touch with you for signatures, I believe.
So, Roger, what's there is a, what was that called?
The form.
No, not just the form. The rubric.
You're still doing that?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
So you have to ask, or have Jorge to ask the Olga to ask for that form.
Okay.
Right. So,
the rubrics. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, I think you'll also probably hearing from me to fill out some basic evaluation form about the PhD proposal. I mean, just to give some warning, it's not that complicated. It's just, you know, you need to fill in a few numbers with respect to various categories that we have identified as important. Right? And I think the scale is from 1 to 5, 5 being you know, very good, and one being not acceptable, right? So I'll send you some more information over email, specifically to Kaushik and Bindu, who may have not done this before.
I've done this before.
Okay. So,
I'm happy to get instructions, Roger.
I'll send you something.
That's good.
Okay. Thanks.
So I think, Raju, I think the for me, the only thing, you just send me the form, I'll fill up the form, and whatever form I need to give you the authorization to sign on my behalf, those are the two things I need to do.
Okay. And we can do this electronically, just to let you know, this form probably would take you 5 minutes or even less, right? It's just a set of maybe 10-15 numbers that you have to fill in. That's it, right? So it's not very complicated. And okay, so you'll hear from both me and Jorge with respect to you know signatures or you know evaluation sheets.
Okay, and first, congratulations to
Roy. Okay, I will. Okay, thank you. All right, thank you, Kaushik and Bindu, and I think safe to hang up now.
All right, thank you, guys.
All right,
thank you.
Bye.
You don't need to sign now, right?
No, I think I'll ask Corey to come and see you for the signature.
Yeah, I'm coming. Bye.